Your Majesties, distinguished guests, it's an honor to speak here at the Paleis Symposium, and I thank Your Majesties for the invitation, first of all, and your commitment to connecting science, culture, and society. Today we will reflect on music and the many ways it shapes our lives, from fostering social connection to supporting our health and well-being. In my presentation, I will focus on music and musicality, our capacity for music, and what the current research reveals about its origins, function, and mechanism, where musicality comes from, and what it enables us to do. But first, with your permission, I would like to begin with a short music fragment. Actually, it's a blind audition. Imagine, and maybe some of you are, that you are a member of the admissions committee of a prestigious music academy. You're among your colleagues, musicians, teachers, and you all have a highly trained ear. And in a moment, you will be hearing a brief excerpt from an ensemble performance, a recording of just 20 seconds long, but that is representative of their quality. And like in a real audition, you have no further information. Normally, you do these auditions behind a curtain. The musicians are behind it, so you don't judge on anything else but what you hear. So to you, the same task. So simple, listen and judge. Before I give you the sound example, I make things slightly easier. There are three possible options. Either is this a professional level improvisation that you will hear in a moment, or are these amateurs that have no idea what they're doing, or is this a very skilled performance by people interpreting a composition by John Cage? So the question is A, B, or C. I'm going to ask you later on. But here is the sound fragment. Are you ready? Okay, you're the experts. This is very serious. Who thinks A? Whoops. Yeah. Who thinks B, who is not happy? Okay. And who thinks C? Wow. Okay. Who knows? You know. It's the right answer. Okay, what I now will do is I will present you the same sound fragment, but now with the original video. You will see first the audience applauding. Then you will see on the video, you see the conductor conducting. And then you will see the musicians. Did somebody change his mind? Okay, a blind audition. What you saw here was actually the Thai Elephant Orchestra. They perform every season for crowds of tourists in Thailand. And it's an impressive sight. Large, majestic animals that seem to adapt to a human form of music making. Yet it is questionable whether they themselves enjoy it. The elephants do what their handlers taught them to do, sometimes with gentle coercion, a poke, a tuck on the ear, to keep them to the rhythm. At, why I show this example is that it shows how difficult it is to judge the so-called musical talent of non-human animals, especially when the judgment is based on what we hear or what we think we hear. In this case, I misled you a little by letting you listen to a live recording and presenting it as a blind audition and subtly steering your expectations. John Cage was apparently also a big attractor. And what happened tells actually little about the elephant's musical ability. It rather tells us something about how we humans listen, how we readily assign meaning, and how eagerly we detect patterns, even when none may exist. Humans are masters of projection. We see faces in clouds, we see patterns in noise. So when we hear sounds, we judge them using our own musical expectations. And that's an interesting phenomenon, but also a fundamental problem. The question whether animals are musical cannot be answered by asking whether something sounds like music. In order to answer this question, we have to investigate something else, not whether something sounds like music, but what it is required to experience something as music. What does an animal, human, elephant, bird, need to be able to perceive, distinguish, and feel before sounds become music? Here, we make a shift from studying the structure of music, think of scales, meters, tone systems, to something deeper and more fundamental, the structure of musicality. Not the notes themselves, but the capacity to make sense of those notes becomes central. Why does a certain melody stick in your mind? What makes one rhythm sound boring and another rhythm exciting? Over the past 20 years, research has shown that virtually all humans have a natural capacity for music, independent of whether you can hear or not, comparable to our inner capacity of, innate capacity, I have to say, of for language. This biological predisposition, the capacity for music, which I will call musicality, consists of a set of traits that develop spontaneously, without explicit instruction, that are shaped and constrained by our cognitive system and the underlying biology. In short, without musicality, there would be no music in human society. What would we need to do to uncover the origins of musicality? The problem is that music leaves no fossils, neither does our brain fossilize. Luckily, researchers have found ingenious ways to trace the evolution of music, and several methods allow us to probe how musicality may have taken shape and have evolved. And I will describe now two of these methods. The first is, one approach is cross-cultural research, in which researchers compare music from diverse cultures to identify what is called universal patterns, similarities in melodic in melodies, harmony, or rhythm. And these studies have been very fruitful. They reveal not only the immense richness and variety of human music, but also remarkable similarities. Similarities that hint at the possibility of a shared biological basis underlying musicality. Still, this approach has remains indirect. It focuses primarily on the music itself, the audible, the observable product of musicality. It does not tell us anything about the underlying capacities that make music possible. So the central question, therefore, remains unsolved. Which abilities are learned and which are innate? Where does biology end? Where does culture begin? And these considerations strongly motivate me and many of my colleagues around the world, not only to study music itself, but also to investigate what underlies it, our capacity to perceive and appreciate music. We also ask, and that will be my next point, to what extent this capacity is shared
with other
non-human animals. And this shift in focus offers us a more direct way to study the biological foundations of music. A comparative perspective can illuminate the origins of musicality. Where does it come from? How did it evolve? And why is it so deeply rooted in our human nature? Like humans, musicality has its own evolutionary tree. An intricate branching network that spans the globe and extends far beyond the beginnings of our species. Musicality is not merely a cultural invention. It appears to have deep biological roots with key traits carried forward through evolution. Yet, as said, it is difficult to find direct evidence for this idea. Sound vanishes, and the musical brain does not leave any fossils. The evolutionary history cannot be excavated. What we can do, however, is to infer its history. Comparative music cognition, so research conducted across cultures and across species, offers a powerful tool to study this evolutionary lineage. By examining whether certain musical traits also appear in other animals, related or not, we can learn something about the biological history of musicality itself. When two closely related species, think of apes and humans, it's reasonable to assume that our common ancestor possessed it as well, this particular musical trait. And this allows us to estimate when a certain component of musicality might have emerged in evolutionary history. When an unrelated or more distant species, think of birds, for instance, we share a common ancestor 320 million years ago, so we had a long trajectory independent of each other. This tells us something about the underlying mechanisms and of the selective pressures that may have shaped it. But, as the example of the Thai elephant orchestra demonstrates, producing something that sounds like music is not a reliable indicator of whether animals are musical. To find out whether an animal is musical, we need more than observation alone. We must design careful listening experiments that reveal what animals, humans included, perceive, what they notice, what they ignore, and which elements of sound they can distinguish or take pleasure in. Both observational and experimental approaches have their place in scientific research. Observation points toward phenomena that are worth interesting, and experiments test whether those apparent abilities are real. To clarify, this is a transition, an intermediate thing I have to say. What came first, music or language? To clarify what is essential to the study of the capacity for music, which components of musicality we might share with other animals, and what their evolutionary history might be, we need to focus on those aspects that are unlikely to be mere products of other cognitive domains, like language, for instance. And this is more complex than one might think. In cognitive science, and especially in linguistics, there has long been a persistent, what I would call a language bias, the tendency to interpret any communicative or auditory phenomenon through a linguistic lens. Anything with intonation or a rhythmic pattern is quickly treated as a form of language or a precursor of it. But music is not a language, at least not in the sense that linguists use the term. It has communicative properties, of course, but it does not use words. It organizes sound, but does not convey literal meaning. Music has its own logic, a temporal, emotional, and affective structure that operates independently of linguistic grammar or semantics. The mere fact that music coexists with language suggests that musicality relies on capacities of which language alone is poorly equipped or even inadequate. I have therefore become increasingly convinced that our sensitivity to music did not arise from language, for instance, as a byproduct of speech-related abilities, as Steven Pinker infamously stated, but likely predates it. Musicality may well have been a biological and cognitive foundation from which both music and language later developed, each with their own in their own way. And that is an idea that was put forward already by Charles Darwin. Empirical evidence for that idea is accumulating. Newborn infants respond enthusiastically to melody and rhythm long before they understand words. Interestingly, people who have lost their language still enjoy music. Numerous birds and marine mammals exhibit melodic and rhythmic behaviors while lacking language. And recent neuroscientific findings indicate that human process speech and melody through distinct and possibly independently evolved neural pathways. These and other findings suggest that musicality is not merely a byproduct of speech, but a much older, more fundamental capacity, a sensitivity to melody and rhythm with a deep evolutionary history. And this insight, this particular insight, opens up a new perspective. Musicality may have emerged from pre-existing building blocks, specific cognitive, motor, or perceptual abilities that were uniquely integrated during evolution. And through this process, musicality may have crystallized into its own biological system, one that later influenced both the development of human language and human music. Excuse me. Final section. The idea that musicality emerged before language and music, as we know them today, is no longer just a philosophical speculation. It has developed into a vibrant research program spanning many scholarly and scientific fields. And researchers are now working to unravel the evolutionary roots of musicality, drawing not only on musicology, psychology and neuroscience, but also on biology, anthropology, and more recently, genetics. The prospect of placing the study of the origins of musicality at the heart of international research is becoming increasingly realistic. A once speculative area within musicality has now evolved into a rapidly advancing interdisciplinary field with an abundance of new, intriguing research questions. These advances make clear that music is not a luxury. It's not just an ornament of culture. It's a central part of what it means to be human. Studying its origins and mechanisms brings together scientists, musicians, practitioners, and clinicians in a common effort to understand why music affects us so deeply and the ways it supports our well-being. I thank you for your attention.